Hello, this is Derek Frost from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Millions Hoped for Her to Succeed. RTI International's Doris Rouse finally cracked the code. Her research was green-lighted to help millions of tuberculosis patients across the globe. And the article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline, Doris Rouse's Lifelong Journey to Save Those Suffering from Tuberculosis, written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. Doris Rouse, a scientist at RTI International, was already years into research she would devote her career to when in 2003 she was told her drug would never work. In front of board members desperately trying to allocate resources, including federal funding, toward treating a form of tuberculosis afflicting millions, a respected federal toxicologist declared her drug hopeless. Brick dust, he called it. But luckily for Rouse and millions of patients, that same brick dust would go on to become the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's approved treatment for a type of tuberculosis, a potentially fatal illness that begins with coughing and chest pains and progresses to fevers, dramatic weight loss, and coughing up blood. The drug she championed would give promise to future patients from long months of agony and even save the roughly 1.6 million people who die each year because of it. Many Triangle researchers spend years taking aim at treating horrible illnesses, facing long odds against the complexities of finding funding and solving the riddles of the human body. Rouse faced a disease where the last breakthrough happened in 1959, and despite significant hurdles, she won. In a region bolstered by a broad life sciences community, she also stands as a testament to the value of the armies of Triangle researchers toiling away in their own pursuits of successful drugs. In a tuberculosis ward in South Africa, one full of emaciated patients, Rouse would learn the value of her work. It was so sad to see those TB patients, she says, her voice lowering and eyes clouding, remembering large rooms of beds full of people who would spend up to 2 years struggling for survival. But then the nurse spoke to us and said, "This drug is working." Eye toward science. Born and raised in Greensboro by an English teacher and an engineer, Rouse grew up with two older brothers and describes herself as an adventurous tomboy. She remembers watching her older brother play baseball when a foul ball struck her in the face, resulting in a number of tooth replacements. Rouse says the ordeal taught her a lesson. "I should have been playing baseball. I wouldn't have gotten hit," she says. Rouse would go on to compete in a different but still male-dominated field. Coming of age during the space race of the 1960s, she fell prey to a strong emphasis on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, education throughout her schooling. And while in middle school, she began taking an active interest in science, largely because of a relationship with a chemistry teacher who Rouse says was an inspiration and important female role model. "It was a fascinating mystery how all these atoms come together to make things," she says. "I couldn't see the direct application of some other sciences, but with chemistry, I could see a direct application in many areas." Following graduation from high school in 1966, Rouse chose to pursue her love for science at Duke University. And though Rouse says throughout her later career she never thought of it being odd, practicing science in an immensely male-dominated field, she says in college she had multiple professors counsel her toward less ambitious careers, advice she spurned. After graduating from Duke in 1970, Rouse joined the Peace Corps. Her deployment took her to a small village deep into upcountry in Liberia, where she spent years teaching science as the only foreigner in the village. She says the friendliness of the people and their welcoming nature, despite harsh conditions, would serve as a driving influence to the rest of her life. "There was this one young student who was very bright but got cerebral malaria," she says, noting how devastating the condition was for many in the country. "He survived it, but he was never the same. That really woke me up." TB sees no color, continent. Returning from Liberia, Rouse wanted to fuse her scientific background with the passion her deployment inspired. Luckily enough, she says Burroughs Welcome, with its own focus on the kind of tropical diseases she had seen firsthand, had just moved into Research Triangle Park. Working as a research scientist tasked with the company's mass spectrometer, Rouse says she again benefited from a lack of bias against female scientists, thanks perhaps to the presence of Nobel Prize-winning biochemist Trudy Elliott. After 4 years, however, Rouse took a part-time position at RTI International while she earned her Ph.D. in physiology and pharmacology at Duke. After graduation, Rouse remained at RTI, where she began work as the director of its Center for Technology Applications. In the role, she worked hand-in-hand with NASA to transfer aerospace technologies into medical applications for which they were not originally developed, such as turning an ultrasound system used to study subsurface flaws in aircraft components into a medical scanner to analyze burn victims. The role required her to bring various agencies, such as the National Institutes of Health, NIH, and NASA, in concert with private industry that could increase the impact of the technology for more than 15 years, an experience that would put her at the helm of the search for a new TB treatment. That moment came in 1998 when Rouse presented at a conference in San Antonio about her work with NASA and public-private partnerships. After her talk, she was approached by an NIH official who pitched her the idea for a similar public-private partnership to cure extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis, or XDR-TB. The last major breakthrough for TB treatment came in 1959, with little new development since. Due to the elongated time period, the bacteria had grown more resistant to original treatment, resulting in XDR-TB. Following her subsequent discussions with the NIH, the agency put out a request for proposal for the project, which was awarded to Rouse and RTI. The following year, she helped launch the nonprofit Global Alliance for TB Drug Development, or TB Alliance for short. Breaking down the complexity. The original task for the alliance was to identify a compound that had any potential as a treatment, meaning TB Alliance. Working mostly through Rouse and her RTI team, spent years identifying and doing due diligence on various compounds. The only analogy you can make is like a startup pharma company, she says. There were maybe 4 people employed by the alliance, and so myself and my team here at RTI was really, as the CEO of the alliance described, the staff only in a different location. That intimacy between RTI's work and TB Alliance would last for the entirety of the project, with Dr. Melvin Spiegelman, TB Alliance's president and CEO, saying the relationship transcended any sort of just legal arrangement. They really are an extension from our perspective of the TB Alliance, he says. They're not TB Alliance employees, but they're close as you could ever come to having somebody who's not an actual employee and full-fledged member of the team to being exactly that. Eventually, Rouse and company found a potential compound, PA-824, at a Seattle-based pathogenesis and began developing it as a pretominid. But the drug was not soluble, meaning it could not be used in animal or human studies, a persistent problem that led to it being called brick dust. Rouse says she believes one of the main ingredients for successful drug development is blessed stubbornness. I won't name any names, but people in organizations that have a great deal of respect and the government said we should not pursue this. It was not going to be a drug, she says. The TB Alliance came to me. We had a discussion on what needed to be done. And I said, I think it can become a drug. And they said, okay, we're with you. Rouse and her team found a new synthesis route and soluble formulation that allowed the drug to enter its first trials in South Africa in 2007. Spiegelman says he does not differentiate between Rouse's and RTI's work for TB Alliance. Doris was always the pivotal point, he says. Whenever there is a question, how should we do this or what should we do, Doris was front and center, the go-to person to work on it and to give us what's always been just unbelievably solid, great advice on what to do. Still, clinical trials proceeded at a grueling pace. Drug-sensitive tuberculosis takes up to 6 months to cure. Drug-resistant tuberculosis treatment can be as long as 24 months, meaning lengthy clinical trials. And the trials were not cheap. According to research cited by TB Alliance, global investment in TB research since 2005 has topped $7.8 billion, including $772 million in 2017 alone. The U.S. government pays 40% of all funding, followed by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation at around 17%. TB Alliance itself reported an annual operating budget of $60 million in 2018. But because of its public and philanthropic roots, the approved pretominid, whose intellectual rights are housed in TB Alliance and licensed in non-exclusive contracts, is not expected to make a return on investment. TB Alliance's licensing deals specifically target patient accessibility. The first official pricing of the drug from the Stop TB Partnership's Global Drug Facility made it available in 150 countries at just $364 for 6 months. Important work. For Rouse, those long trials also made for an intense drug development period with multiple instances in which the process could have fallen apart. Spiegelman says Rouse never despaired. "To call her well-intentioned is such an understatement," he says. RTI CEO Wayne Holden, who began his stint at RTI as one of Rouse's direct superiors, says her ability to connect with people has been an asset, even recounting how her relationship with an Indian American graduate out of UCLA led to the launch of RTI's India offices. Holden says the only time he has seen Rouse anxious was on a flight from California to Texas when the engine of their plane blew out because of a bird flying into the intake. Rouse has little doubt that she would do all the work again if presented the opportunity, but says the work has naturally cost her much of her personal life. On the day she heard the FDA approved the treatment, she says she called her two daughters, both in their adult years, and apologized for being more absent than she would have liked. "I said, you know, I'm sorry that I missed so much time with you because I was traveling everywhere, and I apologize," she remembers. They said, "Mom, don't apologize. We thought it was cool you were doing something important." So that's good because it got rid of my guilt trip. Her older daughter, Nadia Wilson, says watching her mother was an inspiration to make the most of life. "Mom is so kind of genuine and generous, but she's also really fun and adventurous," she says. "That's also part of this. I think she was like, you know what? I'm going to try it. I don't know anything about this TB drug, but I'm going to bring home these books. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to fly to Africa and fly to India, and we're going to do it." At last, breakthrough. Rouse is the last person to bring up her own personal satisfaction about FDA approval. Holden says he did not hear from Rouse about the drug approval until he randomly ran into her a few days later in the company's cafeteria. Instead, Rouse is prone to retelling a story told by a physician who led the clinical trials in South Africa, who worked in a TB ward where the patients were kept in isolation. One patient was failing to respond to any drugs at all and was placed on the still experimental treatment. A couple of weeks later, someone was walking by and heard sobbing, and they thought maybe she's having a psychotic break or maybe it's a side effect of the drug, she says. So they sent mental health professionals in there, and when they went in, they realized she was sobbing because she was happy, because she was feeling better and would get out and be able to go home. Rouse sees herself as the beneficiary of a series of fortuitous encounters, mentors, and experiences, but she is also a rarity in the pursuit of cures. Countless other researchers throughout the globe will spend their lives devoted to the same kind of work, but few receive the electric news their treatments truly work. That moment came for Rouse August 14, more than 20 years since work began. Sitting in her RTI office in Research Triangle Park on a Wednesday morning, she received a call that the FDA had approved the drug. Rouse, a calm and dignified scientist with nearly 50 years of research experience, stepped into the hallway outside her office and screamed in joy. "I was just as happy as I could be," she says. "I was crying all day." And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Rise founder finds an outlet in nature after tough years. Tom Ferguson founded what is now Rise Southern Biscuits and Righteous Chicken in 2012, and the company based in Durham has expanded to 5 other states. But as the company exploded, his own life imploded as he struggled with internal demands at the company and a pivot away from donuts. That was really stressful, Ferguson says. A lot of people bought in for the biscuits and donuts, and I was saying I didn't see a future in donuts. As the company grew and the challenges mounted, he turned to alcohol and drugs. 2 years ago, he landed in rehab in Malibu, California. Even after that, he suffered a classic nervous breakdown, and a doctor told him, "What you need is a hobby." Gosh, thought Ferguson, maybe I should take up bird watching. So he joined 3 bird watching clubs, and this year has traveled to 20 states and may see as many as 400 species. Even this week, he was in Texas near the Rio Grande for a bird watching event. There's a lot of stuff coming out over the last year about the therapeutic values with birds, he says. Ferguson says he used to get irate at employees who made mistakes, but as a novice birder, he has misidentified birds, broken expensive cameras, and become more patient with others. I pushed it my whole life, and I pushed it really hard and sacrificed family time with the kids, Ferguson says. But the one thing that bit me in the butt first was not paying enough attention to myself. My advice would be to find a hobby. This only made me better at work. My partners and franchisors would say this made me better. What I'm trying to preach is tell people to find your hobby. Find a hobby out with nature if you can. 2 orthopedic practices to merge but keep brands. A merger of 2 of the Triangle's leading orthopedic practices caught the attention of Biz. Raleigh Orthopedic, which has 24 physicians, is merging with Cary Orthopedic and Sports Medicine Specialists, which has 15. Raleigh Orthopedic has some high-profile connections in the community, serving as the official team doctors for NC State University, the Carolina Hurricanes, and Shaw University. It also raises the question of who leads the combined group, and does Cary Orthopedics change its name? Turns out Cary will retain its name, as it has been in business since 1982, and will become shareholders in Raleigh Orthopedic sometime in the spring. Brian Bizub will remain as CEO of Raleigh Orthopedic. Huge crowd expected for Final Four this season. Basketball season is finally underway, and it's interesting to note that the road to the Final Four this season leads to what are expected to be record crowds. Atlanta's Mercedes-Benz Stadium will host the NCAA Final Four, and crowds may exceed 80,000 each day. This will be the largest build we've ever done, LJ Wright, the NCAA Director of Men's Basketball Championships, tells Atlanta Business Chronicle. We're going to bring in 95 semi-trucks worth of equipment. It's going to be a little over 25,000 in temporary seats that we're bringing into the stadium. It's a massive, massive build. Could a Triangle team be there? Perhaps. Both Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill are ranked in the top 10 early in the season. Krispy Kreme reverses course with college student. North Carolina-based Krispy Kreme is going to let Minnesota college student Jason Gonzalez keep going after all. The Metropolitan State University senior had been driving to Iowa on Saturdays and filling his car with 100 boxes of donuts, then driving back and selling them for up to $20 per box. But Gonzalez told the St. Paul Pioneer Press a Krispy Kreme executive said that created a liability for the company. Krispy Kreme has not operated in Minnesota for more than 10 years. But after a slew of publicity, the company reversed course. We wish Jason great success, and we're thrilled to help him achieve it by donating 500 dozen donuts when he restarts his business, it said. Bankers pack the ballroom at Carolina Country Club. It's not the holiday season just yet, but the ballroom at Raleigh's Carolina Country Club was still packed November 6 when Triangle Business Journal held a power breakfast on the changing landscape of North Carolina banking. Speaking at the event were Morgan Davis, president and CEO of Town Bank, Steve Jones, CEO of Dogwood State Bank, and Brian Jordan, president and CEO of First Horizon National. But Biz, when looking up from a hefty plate of bacon, saw plenty of other heavy hitters in the crowd, including Brenda Bost of Bost Homes, John Rufty of the Rufty Companies, John Sprink, market president for Home Trust Bank, Gary Green, CEO of Green Resources, Kurt Ladig, president and CEO of Delta Dental of North Carolina, Elaine Marshall, the North Carolina Secretary of State, Lori O'Keefe, president and CEO of the Triangle Community Foundation, Karen Shanahan of Shanahan Law Group, and Ford Robertson, managing partner of Kilpatrick Townsend. So the lesson on drawing a crowd, have a great topic, strong speakers, and mounds of bacon. National champions look ahead in women's soccer. After the team's 2019 National Women's Soccer League victory, Terry's own North Carolina Courage offered new contracts to 5 players and exercised options on 18 players. And U.S. Women's National Team players Abby Dahlkemper, Crystal Dunn, Samantha Muse, and McCall Zabroni, and Canadian goalkeeper Stephanie Laube will remain on the Courage roster as 2019 allocated Federation players, the team announced recently. The club also announced that it would not offer Julia Spetsmark or Casey Tillman new player agreements. As announced early in the 2019 season, former UNC Chapel Hill star Heather O'Reilly is retiring from professional soccer after a 17-year career. O'Reilly spent her final 2 seasons with the Courage. And now we turn to the On Technology Echo Devo page in the Triangle Business Journal. This is written by Lauren Onasorge. The first article, SAS struts stuff in Milan. The Kerry company goes to the fashion capital to promote analytics. The models walked down the runway amid bright lights in Milan, but they weren't selling their styles this time, not even the bright red Vivian Westwood gown finale. What they were selling were analytics, data crunching technology fueled by triangle-born innovation. Jim Goodnight, CEO of Kerry-based SAS Institute, deemed it an appropriate showcase of what his company can do. Since Milan is one of the great fashion capitals, he told the crowd at Analytics Experience in Milan last month, Thank you all for helping us to bring a little bit of high fashion to the analytics experience, he said. As 3 models walked by, the computer identified their name, as well as what they were wearing, down to the designer. But Goodnight says fashion is hardly SAS's endgame. Our market focused on data and analytics is full of hype and unfulfilled promises, he said. Each day there seems to be another competitor talking about all the great things you can do with artificial intelligence. And it's not just fashion. Goodnight sees particular potential in healthcare. On stage, he brought up Dr. Gert Casimir, professor of surgery and director of surgical oncology at Amsterdam UMC. Casimir is studying colorectal cancer that has metastasized or spread to the liver. Colorectal cancer is the 3rd most common type of cancer worldwide, and metastases happen in about half of those patients. The best treatment is surgery, he said, but not all patients qualify because of the size of their tumors. Those patients, the subject of Casimir's study, undergo chemotherapy to shrink lesions. Then radiologists analyze the results using a set of criteria, measuring the diameters of the tumor both before and after chemotherapy. If it decreases by at least 30%, the patient is responding to treatment. This classification of the patient determines how we proceed with the treatment, Casimir said on stage. Until now, all this work has been done manually. Through SAS software, which uses computer vision and predictive analytics, evaluation criteria becomes more objective and more accurate, and it has the potential to be used in other solid tumor cases. I believe that anything we can identify with the human eye, we can train a computer to identify as well, Goodnight said. Downtown locale boosts hiring for IDC. Issuer Direct Corporation is on a hiring streak. The CEO and CEO Brian Balberni says its new downtown Raleigh headquarters is helping it fill the seats. When asked if he was having trouble filling open positions, he said, "We're not right now. I think if we were in Morrisville, the answer would be yes, but being here, that has helped us." The communications and compliance firm relocated to downtown Raleigh in September and has been on a hiring streak, adding 5 to its sales team in recent days. And it's planning more sales hires, as well as operational roles. SolarWinds CEO staffing up after Samanage deal. Nearly 6 months after its $329 million buyout of Kerry-based Samanage closed, SolarWinds of Texas continues to have big plans for the unit and its North Carolina team. In an interview, Triangle Business Journal asked SolarWinds CEO Kevin Thompson how the Triangle headcount has fared post-deal. We did not make any headcount reductions when we made this acquisition, he says. We are actually growing the team. Today, SolarWinds' North Carolina presence includes 250 employees. This month, Samanage employees are moving into SolarWinds' main Morrisville office, which can handle the expanded headcount. But we are negotiating right now to add another floor, Thompson says. This is a growth acquisition for us. They're just super highly skilled and built a really great product. SolarWinds had been watching the IT management space for years, having been acquainted with Samanage and its management team prior to the deal. And it saw a problem. When it came to small and medium-sized businesses, existing software used by major enterprises just wasn't accessible. SolarWinds saw an opportunity, he says, in making the technology consumable to smaller firms. That was the vision we had for the acquisition, Thompson says, noting that so far, it's working. And in a section called Behind the Deal, how North Carolina beat South Carolina, Kentucky to land Indian Outfit. Kalyani Group will put jobs in Sanford. Indian conglomerate Kalyani Group announced in September it had picked Sanford for what economic developers would call a trophy project consisting of 460 jobs and a $170 million investment. That's despite competition from other states whose incentives lapped what North Carolina's own Economic Investments Committee approved. Nearly 1,200 pages of documents highlight the state's successful pursuit. The state faced hefty competition, according to what the firm told the state. Aiken, South Carolina offered $56.7 million, and Bowling Green, Kentucky offered $13.6 million in total incentives. The firm told North Carolina officials it expected the automobile industry to drive its business forward and was planning to manufacture key components required by car makers in country. The project includes Kalyani Precision Machining at 156 new jobs and a forging subsidiary, Bharat Forge Aluminum, at 304 jobs. The state eventually offered an incentives package worth nearly $8.4 million, including nearly $1 million in Department of Transportation offerings and more than $5 million in combined JDIGs. Lee County and Sanford would come up with another $8.3 million to reel in Bharat, records show. And finally, in a section called He Said It, on issues of the public purse, we can talk about credibility anytime he wants to. And that's from Dale Folwell, state treasurer, on Governor Roy Cooper after Cooper's office put out a statement questioning Folwell's credibility after Folwell called for the resignation of the North Carolina Department of Transportation Secretary Jim Trogdon over the department's ongoing cash crunch. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Caleb Harshberger. The first headline, developer pitches mixed-use project at library and park in downtown Cary. Three longtime Cary families have partnered to bring a new mixed-use development to downtown on a piece of town-owned land beside the newly opened Cary Regional Library. Academy Park Cary, a development team comprised of the Near family, the Stevenson family, and the Zahn family presented the project at a recent town council work session with submitted plans calling for two mixed-use buildings abutting the recently opened Cary Library and the adjoining parking deck. The families have a history of development projects in the region, both individually and as a group. Town of Cary Economic Development Director Ted Boyd says the town acquired the land for the park and library projects years ago, and upon completing the master plans realized that about 2 acres of the land was not needed. The extra parcel has since become the site of the proposed Academy Park Cary project. The site for the project is adjacent to the newly built Cary Regional Library, which held its grand opening November 3. The library is 30,000 square feet with a 600-space town-owned parking deck. Construction of both facilities cost around $23.7 million, of which the town's portion was expected to be $13 million. Boyd says the town is working on coming to an agreement with the developers about providing the new project access to the parking deck, negotiating upkeep fees, and so on. The development would join a growing list of mixed-use projects in the area. Just down the road on Walnut Street, the new owners of the Cary Town Center, Turnbridge Equities, and Denali Properties want to convert the property from a shopping mall into a mixed-use center with development as high as 12 stories. Altogether, the rezoning the owners are requesting would allow for as much as 1.2 million square feet of office space, 360,000 square feet of commercial space, and 1,800 multifamily townhouse units, as well as up to 300 hotel rooms. Club Corps pays more than $10 million for Triangle Country Clubs. A Dallas-based private golf and country club giant has closed on its purchases of two Triangle Country Clubs, with Wake County records showing the company paid over $10 million for the pair. Club Corps bought the Hassentree Club in Wake Forest and Briar Creek Country Club in Raleigh as part of a seven-club portfolio previously owned by Horsham, Pennsylvania real estate company Toll Brothers. The sale closed November 4. Club Corps paid $9.8 million for the Briar Creek Club and $750,000 for Hassentree, according to deed records. "We're excited to announce the addition of these exceptional lifestyle clubs to our portfolio and welcome their members and employees to the Club Corps family," CEO David Pillsbury said. Briar Creek Country Club features an 18-hole Arnold Palmer signature golf course and 40,000-square-foot clubhouse. Monthly membership dues are $476 with a $7,500 initiation fee. Toll Brothers began construction on the Briar Creek Country Club in 1999. The Hassentree Club features a 16,500-square-foot clubhouse, bar, and grill room. Monthly membership dues are $450 with an $11,000 initiation fee. Toll Brothers bought the Hassentree Club in 2010. Former police headquarters to be redeveloped in Durham. The Durham City Council has voted to begin negotiations with the staff-recommended firm in the proposed sale and redevelopment of the city's former police department headquarters after extending the competition for the project last month. After considering additional revisions to competing proposals, the city's General Services Department once again recommended the Fallon Company out of Boston to purchase and redevelop the property at 505 West Chapel Hill Street. On November 5, the council voted to begin negotiations. The decision comes a month after the staff recommended the group before granting a request from a competing firm to accept revised petitions, briefly extending the competition for the project. The building for the former police headquarters first opened in the 1950s when it housed the Home Security Life Insurance Company. And finally, new details revealed on Nexus condo tower, The Nash. The developers behind a massive project known as The Nexus in downtown Raleigh are shining more light on the condo tower as they prepare to begin site work as soon as early next year. Dubbed The Nash, the 20-story tower will feature over 100 upscale condominiums with floor plans ranging from one-bedroom homes to penthouse suites, and amenities including hotel-style offerings such as concierge services. The tower will be one of four in the Nexus, a mixed-use development with three 20-story towers and one 19-story tower at the corner of McDowell and Hargett Streets. The property is owned by the Acquisition Group of California, and Chapel Hill-based real estate development company East West Partners is developing the property in partnership with the owner. Lee Perry, Senior Managing Partner of Development with East West Partners, says the condo tower was always part of the plan with Nexus. "Ever since we've been working on the project, we knew there would be a significant condominium component to it and planned it all along. There's not been much condo product built in downtown Raleigh since the recession," he says. "You've seen most of what's been built in the last few years has mostly been for rent." Perry says that supply shortage has led to pent-up demand as residents and newcomers find more and more reasons to want to live in the downtown area. Additionally, East West already has two condo projects underway, one in Wilmington and one in Durham. "We know how to build condos. We've got a lot of experience," Perry says. Interested buyers can put a deposit down to reserve the units beginning early next year. Pricing has yet to be released, though Perry says The Nash will have a wide variety of offerings for customers in all stages of life. "We're going to have something for everyone," he says, "everything from younger professionals to empty nesters." Dogwood Properties is handling sales and marketing for the condos. In total, Plans for the Nexus call for a 325,000 square foot office tower, a 250 room hotel, 45,000 square feet of street level retail, and around 400 residential units with 300 apartments. The McDowell Street property, located next to Nash Square, served as the headquarters of the News and Observer. And now we turn to the page written by Seth Thomas Gulledge on healthcare and education. Red Hill scores FDA approval for lead drug. An Israeli company with its U.S. headquarters in Raleigh has received its long-anticipated approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, meaning it will start commercialization efforts it hopes will net a profit. Over the last year, Red Hill Biopharma has been steadily growing its executive and commercial team in the Triangle in preparation for the FDA approval of Talicia. The drug is a treatment for Helicobacter pylori infection, a bacteria that can cause ulcers. With that approval in hand, the company says it plans to kick off commercialization in the first quarter 2020. CEO Dror Ben Asher said Red Hill is working to expand our sales force to approximately 140 representatives who will promote Talicia, as well as other gastrointestinal-focused products in the company's basket. The FDA's approval of Talicia demonstrates our unwavering dedication to patients suffering from gastrointestinal diseases, he said in a prepared statement. According to company estimations, more than 2 million people in the U.S. are treated for H. pylori infection each year, affecting approximately 35% of the U.S. adult population. The infection is a carcinogen and comes with a strong risk factor for the development of peptic ulcer disease, gastritis, and non-cardia gastric cancer. The market for H. pylori therapies was about $4.83 billion as of 2015. The company reports $59 million in cash and short-term investments. A large portion of its current financial position is the result of a recent deal struck with Ireland-based Cosmo Pharmaceuticals for the rights to commercialize Aemcolo, a treatment for traveler's diarrhea caused by non-invasive E. coli. The deal brought Red Hill an immediate $36 million, and the company will pay percent royalties and milestone payments to Cosmo based on its success. Research Triangle Park drug maker raises $15 million towards Alzheimer's research. A Research Triangle Park company looking to fight Alzheimer's disease has closed a sizable fundraising round. T3D Therapeutics has raised $15 million in equity offerings, according to a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The filing states the round began October 25. T3D Therapeutics is based around the development of its lead candidate, T3D-959, an orally administered treatment for Alzheimer's. The drug is currently in a Phase 2 study, and the new funding will allow it to progress into its next trial. We believe T3D-959 has the potential to be Alzheimer's disease remedial, to either slow, stop, or even reverse the course of disease as a single drug therapy, CEO John Didsbury said in a statement. In addition to the recent funding round, which the company says was financed from an unidentified cornerstone investor, T3D has also received funding from the National Institute on Aging. Its filing with the SEC confirms the $15 million in new funding came from a single investor. The $15 million is the first reported round since March 2018, when the company held an $18 million offering with only one investor participating. Just 2 months prior to that, it had raised an additional $700,000. UNC Health changes executive roles. The UNC Health System has made several changes in its executive leadership, a shakeup it says will increase oversight and integration of its growing assets. Included in the list of restructured positions is the first woman to be named president of the UNC hospitals and expanded responsibilities for UNC healthcare executives such as Gary Park and Steve Burris. Park, the former president of UNC Hospitals, has been tapped as the chief operating officer of UNC Healthcare and will be tasked with overseeing all hospital and ambulatory operations. In his place, Janet Hayter, a former senior vice president of operations, has been tapped as the president of UNC Hospitals, which covers the hospitals in Chapel Hill. She began her career as a nurse more than 30 years ago. UNC said the restructuring is part of a plan to better integrate hospitals, clinics, and physician practices. Burris, the president of UNC Rex Healthcare, has become the president of the Triangle Region, reporting directly to Park and overseeing the leaders at UNC Hospitals, Rex, and its ambulatory centers. In his place, Ernie Bovio, who just recently joined Rex as chief operating officer, will become the president of UNC Rex as well as the new Holly Springs Hospital. Wake Tech seeks land for new campus in Wendell. The Triangle's largest community college is looking to grow even larger with plans to purchase more than 100 acres in the eastern reaches of Wake County. Wake Technical Community College, under the leadership of new president Scott Rawls, has entered into a purchase agreement for 106 acres in Wendell, hoping it will be the future site of an east campus. Rawls, the former president of the North Carolina Community College System, who began his role at Wake Tech in April, says the location would round out the college's geographic presence in the county. "We think it's a strong strategic move for our college right now," he says. "It's an area of our county that needs us, where we are not as much." The 106 acres are part of three parcels alongside the I-87 U.S. 64 business corridor near the Rollsville Road and Wendell Boulevard exits. The college plans to purchase the land for $10.6 million, pending approval from the Wake County Board of Commissioners and the State Board of Community Colleges, as well as a 180-day due diligence period. If the land purchase is approved, the college plans to build the campus out over an undetermined time frame, though Rawl says he would like to see a four-year window. At first, the land will be the site of another education and training site, but Rawl says they plan to develop it into a full campus. He says the facility investment for the campus will be roughly the same as its Research Triangle Park location. "We believe it's part of our county that needs us for a number of reasons," he says. "We think it's a growing part of our county. Knightdale and Wendell have been two of the fastest growing communities, not just in Wake County, but in the state." And finally, these are the zip codes you want for a long, healthy life. In the Triangle, the stark contrast in access to food, medical services, and lifestyle factors may affect a person's life expectancy by more than a decade, according to research conducted by Virginia Commonwealth University's Center on Society and Health. The study shows that life expectancy in the Triangle varies greatly by zip code. Of all the zip codes in Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill, the highest life expectancy is found in the 27617 zip code, the Briar Creek area, where life expectancy is as high as 88 years on average. Meanwhile, the 27610 zip code in southeast of Raleigh reports a life expectancy of 76. Dr. John Lumpkin, the president of Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina Foundation, says the variance over a small geographic region and so close to world-class medical facilities is demonstrative of how much other factors play in public health. "Behind the numbers, the difference is due to differential rates of food insecurity, poverty, access to affordable, safe housing, and access to transportation, quality early childhood education, among others," he says. "To have better outcomes and total cost of care, those issues need to be addressed. But disparities within the Triangle can pale in contrast to other areas of the state. As a whole, VCU's analysis of data shows that the life expectancy for Wake County averages 80 years, but as you move east across the state, those averages drop steadily, with Nash County averaging 75 years and Martin County averaging just 73 years. And now we turn to Dathan Kazakh's page on restaurants and retail. This scientific experiment yields cocktail mix. What do you get when you have a group of four friends who are scientists and chemists, love to drink, and are looking for the perfect mixer for their spirits? You get Horball's Drinking Vinegar, which came into existence in March to perfect the ultimate drink using shrubs. Co-owner Rob Schmidt says the name has an unusual background. It goes back to a horrible movie featuring actor Gerard Butler, he says. The 2017 movie Geostorm was, as he says, so bad that a friend of another co-owner's child drew an illustration of them watching the movie, and inside the screen was the word horball, which was meant to read horrible. Schmidt says that when they were coming up with a name for the business, it was a no-brainer. The product, Horball's Drinking Vinegar, takes all their scientific knowledge and combines that into the company's four flagship mixers: blueberry lemon, cucumber mint, peach rosemary, and strawberry mint. Along with Schmidt, Horball's ownership group includes Colin Blakely, Jesse Reherzer, and Dan Driscoll. The four friends have recently been on a push to get their shrub, a drinking vinegar, out into the local market and beyond. We're currently in a few bottle shops, such as Bottle Mix in Raleigh and Wine and Bar 101 in Wake Forest, says Blakely. The foursome is also finding some distribution in Asheville and selling their product on Amazon and also through Total Wine. Horballs is now planning to ramp up distribution and to team up with local distilleries. Smithsonian event includes local brewery. Raleigh Brewing Company will be included in the latest display by the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. The showcase, located within the Food Transforming the American Table, began October 25. This permanent exhibit will explore the history of food in the United States since 1950. One of its four major sections is titled Brewing a Revolution. Meanwhile, a moderated conversation November 8 will feature some key figures in the history of craft beer, such as Fritz Maytag of Anchor Brewing Company, Ken Grossman, founder of Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, and Charlie Papazon, founder of the Association of Brewers. During the event, Raleigh Brewing will be pouring Hell Yes Ma'am Belgian Golden Ale, and Raleigh Brewing CEO Christy Neistat, in an alliance with Rene DeLuca, will breathe life into the fabled New Albion label with the New Albion Ale. DeLuca is the daughter of Jack McAuliffe, the original creator of New Albion Ale. McAuliffe created the first craft brewery in post-Prohibition America, and his life is part of the new display at the National Museum of American History. Hot days, rainy weekends are among challenges for North Carolina wineries. The challenges facing North Carolina's wine industry, including changing weather conditions, were the subject October 25 in Rhonda, when NC Department of Environmental Quality Secretary Michael Regan met with winery and business owners in western North Carolina to discuss the industry as a whole. The group also discussed the industry's efforts to be more sustainable. All this comes from what the state plans on doing to change its carbon footprint through Executive Order 80 and the development of the Clean Energy Plan. Weinberger Mark Frizzlowski of Childress Vineyards in Lexington said North Carolina is one of the only places in the U.S. where it is affordable to start a winery, but he also noted that it is a risky business. A low yield for 2 or 3 years can put a vineyard out of business, Frizzlowski said. Several winemakers discussed how the changing climate conditions can impact a vineyard. For example, days of rain can ruin the fruit and keep tourists away on weekends. The consensus was it is extremely difficult to work in extreme heat, and wineries might have to invest in infrastructure to pick grapes at night. On a positive note, Barbara Raffaldini, co-owner of Raffaldini Vineyards and Winery in Rhonda, said, "One of the reasons we came to North Carolina is the natural beauty. It's a real tourist destination. People want to enjoy the natural beauty and the natural resources that are here. There needs to be a balance if we want North Carolina to be competitive," said Regan, talking about a way to marry the natural resources of the state with the growing economy. He also thanked the wineries for being active business partners in helping the state prosper. Latin-themed restaurant to open on top of Durham.id. Rooftop Dining in the Triangle is about to add another option with Gonza Tacos and Tequila's new restaurant, Macondo Latin Cuisine, opening at the Durham.id building in late 2020. The first Macondo will open at Sojourn Glenwood Place in Raleigh early next year. Macondo will feature Latin flavors that will change seasonally. The vision, says Gonza's co-founder, Carlos Rodriguez, is a straightforward, simple, culinary-driven menu, but with high complexity. Rodriguez and partner Gonza Salamanca have teamed up with Colombian chef Santiago Machis as a menu consultant. When we conceptualized the Macondo brand, we knew we wanted to have a Durham location, says Rodriguez. The new location will overlook the West Village Gonza Tacos and Tequila location. And finally, in a section called Coming Attraction, there's a quote. I am thrilled to plant roots here and add my own experiences and passion for reimagined Southern cuisine to one of the fastest growing areas of the country. And that is from Kenny Gilbert, celebrity chef, on the opening of his wood-fired Southern-style cuisine restaurant slated to open in February in North Raleigh. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Apple makes first move to tackle affordability. Who's next? Looks like tech giant Apple is convinced that ignoring the housing affordability problem will not make it go away. A few days ago, the Cupertino, California-based tech giant announced it will commit $2.5 billion toward easing the California housing availability and affordability crisis. About $1 billion of that money will go into a new investment fund, $1 billion towards a first-time homebuyer mortgage assistance program, $300 million in Apple-owned land that will be used to build affordable housing, and $200 million to support lower-income housing in the Bay Area. The situation in the Triangle may not be as dire as Silicon Valley, where people are leaving in droves. 300,000 people left San Francisco between April and June. But we also do not want to experience what happens if the situation gets worse. Raleigh has an affordability problem. In fact, the same can be said about Durham and Chapel Hill. While home prices have risen at a sustained rate since the Great Recession, wages have not maintained that pace. Lower interest rates help ease the situation in the recent past, but for households earning about $70,000 per year, housing increasingly is becoming unaffordable. Sure, they can live 40 miles from their workplace where prices are more reasonable, but it fails to address the need of urban affordability for a broader class of citizens. Apple's move may trigger some socially responsible CEOs such as Salesforce's Mark Benioff, BlackRock's Larry Fink, or J.P. Morgan Chase's Jamie Dimon to tackle the issue of affordability. Coupled with government assistance and the loosening of some regulations relating to qualifying standards, these efforts could be a start to solve an issue which is one of the biggest hindrances to America's growth. So the question is, who in our local corporate circle is going to step up? Could it be SaaS that can intentionally address corporate social responsibility with a statement initiative? Could it be Red Hat? Or will it be some other, or will it be our quieter corporate citizens in the area, such as Martin Marietta and Advance Auto Parts? On November 5, the Durham residents approved the issuance of $95 million in affordable housing bonds that will now result in the city adding 1,600 new affordable housing units and 800 rental units within the city's core. The bond money will also move 1,700 homeless individuals to permanent housing and assist first-time homebuyers to buy from a new pool of 400 units. Kudos to Durham residents for passing the measure. Now it's Raleigh's turn to go big. The city's new mayor-elect and the new city council already have indicated affordability will be one of the first issues taken up next year. This may be a good time for our local government to start talking to some of our corporate citizens about coming up with a model that relies on shared responsibility. Then we truly become a stronger community with everyone rowing in the same direction. And now turning to some general news, Shaw University to evaluate leveraging its real estate. This article is written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. A historically black university in the heart of downtown Raleigh is bringing on a consultant to explore the use of its real estate holdings. Shaw University, located on the south end of downtown Raleigh, has announced it will bring on the Urban Land Institute, or ULI, to assess the potential effect of a more strategic program of urban development and to explore opportunities to leverage Shaw's location at the juncture of downtown and southeast Raleigh. ULI, a network of real estate and land use experts, will conduct a week-long assessment, including interviews with community stakeholders, starting in mid-November. According to county records, the university's main campus of about 26 acres has a total land and building valuation of over $93 million. However, some, such as North Carolina Football Club owner Steve Malik, who is pushing for a sports and entertainment complex not far from the Shaw campus, believe the land could be valued considerably higher. Shaw's move comes during a period of regrowth for the university as it recovers from years of slumping enrollment and revenue. Full-time enrollment was as high as 3,076 in 2007 and has since fallen to just 1,550 in the last academic year. The university managed to operate in a surplus in the last fiscal year after seeing 3 years of continuous deficits. And we'll read as much as we can of this article. Durham clinical research firm continues growth. A recently launched Durham clinical site company has doubled its size again, the latest in an aggressive acquisition strategy core to its business model. Velocity Clinical Research, a Durham-based company that launched in February, has announced the acquisition of Advanced Clinical Research, ACR, and Rapid Medical Research, RMR. Together, the two companies represent six research centers in California, Idaho, Texas, Utah, Washington, and Ohio. The company originally launched with the acquisition of the Clinical Research Institute of Southern Oregon of Medford, Oregon, New Horizons Clinical Research of Cincinnati, and MD Clinical of Hallandale Beach, Florida. And we'll stop there as the company reports now having 10 sites under its control. And we have run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. And be sure to listen next time. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.